Hello, 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 and thank you for tuning in to The Rundown here on WNYU 89.1 FM New York and online everywhere at WNYU.org. I'm your host, Ray Swanabo. We've got a great show for you guys tonight. Maria Josefina Saldana Portillo will join us live or over Zoom to discuss the Supreme Court's decision to overturn abortion rights. Anna Miller and Lisa Schmidt explore hidden New York City architectural gems. An NYU journalism class covers what New Yorkers think of federal transportation mask mandates. And finally, Izzy McMahon talks about the cyber attacks in healthcare. For our first story, to talk about the Supreme Court's leaked draft to overturn Roe v. Wade, I am being joined live over Zoom with Maria Josefina Saldana Portillo. She's a professor of the Department of Social and Culture Analysis and the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies here at NYU. Can you hear me?
I can, Grace. I can hear you now.
Awesome. Hi, welcome. First off, can you give our audience a bit of a rundown of who you are and what you teach?
I'm a professor at NYU in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis and with the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies. My areas of specialization are Latinx studies, Indigenous studies, and gender and sexuality studies.
Awesome. So what groups of people are going to be most impacted by this reversal?
Well, those who will be most adversely affected are obviously poor women, be they Black, White, Indigenous, Latinx, or Asian American. They're going to be the most adversely affected. And even before the pandemic, fully one-third of mothers reported not being able to afford diapers. So the reversal of Roe versus Wade is going to dictate the families, not just women, but families who can not afford to have children that they must, regardless of what their personal financial situation is. So I'm urging all of you, if you're as angry as I am about the possible reversal of Roe v. Wade, to donate regularly and often to the National Network of Abortion Funds. You can go to their website. In a good year, up until this point, the abortion funds are able to meet only a quarter of the demand for them. But with poor women having to now travel out of state, take time off of work, these funds are going to be even more sought after. So that would be my advice.
And then what do you think will happen if Justice Samuel Alito's opinion becomes the framework for the Supreme Court's decision on abortion?
Well, fortunately, at this moment, it doesn't look like there's a majority in Congress that could pass, for example, a national ban, even if a national ban of abortions, even if Republicans were to take over the Senate, the House, and the presidency. So at least they will not be able at this point to ban it nationally. However, Alito is, Supreme Court justices in general are terrible historians, and Alito gets the history of abortions in this country wrong. Up until the 19th century, abortions were not only legal, they were safe, and they were handled primarily by midwives and nurses, not by doctors. It isn't until the 19th century that some restrictions start to be applied, and it isn't until the early 20th century that abortion is banned nationally, and this is due primarily to the work of doctors who at that moment wanted to professionalize and form the AMA and wanted to oust nurses and midwives from the very lucrative field of reproductive health. So, I don't think that a ban on abortion will be as devastating as it was prior to 1973, primarily because of new technologies, right, including pills that you can use up to the 20th week of pregnancy that allow you to perform the abortion safely in your home. But this decision will open the door for states that ban abortions at any moment to criminalize not just the women who get abortions, but the providers, right, the doctors, anyone who assists in it, to criminalize them, and we will see people going to prison in these states because they performed abortions or had an abortion, even though in the state next door this may be legal.
And then you say that the reversal of Roe v. Wade is an attempt by the court to impose the will of the minority on the majority of U.S. citizens. Can you say more on that?
Well, yes. Depending on which poll you're reading, you know, Washington Post, ABC, or the New York Times, between 57 and 67% of the U.S. population, men and women, support upholding Roe and support safe and legal abortions in most circumstances. So a Supreme Court that has been appointed in very, very questionable ways since Mitch McConnell denied President Obama, the replacement of that Supreme Court justice. The court is imposing the will of this moral minority on the majority of U.S. citizens who actually believe abortion should be safe and legal and accessible. And that's only to the structural limitations of our electoral laws and constitution that allow the opinions of the minority to hold such sway in the U.S. Senate.
And then finally, you have your own personal story when it comes to abortion rights. Would you care to share?
Yes, I would like to share. I think it's important. Yeah. Now, and I wanted to also add that this is the first time I've ever shared this story. I went to undergrad in 1979, so just 6 years after Roe v. Wade was decided. And I had to get an abortion because I was the first person from my hometown of Laredo, Texas, which is 98% Mexican American, to ever be accepted to Yale. It was a huge deal. Everybody supported me going. But if I had gotten pregnant as an undergraduate, well, I did get pregnant as an undergraduate, but if I had gone through with that pregnancy, if I hadn't had an abortion available to me, even though everyone in my family and my town supported me going to this very prestigious undergraduate institution, they would equally have put pressure on me to come home and have that child. And I don't know if I would have had the life I had. I don't know if I would have had a good life if I would have been forced to make that decision, but I wouldn't have had the life I have now. And I'm so happy with the life I've had now. You know, I chose never to have children, and I did that for professional and personal reasons. And that was my choice. And having an abortion, I know lots of people will tell you that it's the hardest decision I'll ever make. It wasn't the hardest decision I've ever made by far. And I felt nothing but relief once that was over. And that service was provided by my university healthcare, right? So I want all women of any age to have that easy access to the services, There were mental health services offered to me. I didn't use them, but I imagine other women did after going through that process. So that's what I want what I had at 19 available to every woman in this country, whatever age.
That's wonderful. And what would you have to say to students, females at NYU, who are seeing this and are afraid and feel helpless?
Well, they shouldn't feel helpless. That never helps anybody.
Yeah,
to feel helpless,
true.
You know? We need to organize. We need to continue to organize, right? Things like the National Abortion Fund, they've been doing this at the grassroots level, even just to help poor women, you know, have access to abortions ever since they banned Planned Parenthood from giving abortions, right? Or, you know, federally subsidized abortions. So there's a grassroots effort that's already underway. We need to obviously protest, but we also need to change our election laws. We need to even though I'm a Texan who did seek refuge in New York City, ultimately, you know, we need to go back to these red states and organize the electorate in these red states so that we can make sure that safe and free abortions are available to everyone nationally. We're fine and we're safe in New York for now. We're safe in California for now, right? All of those blue states in which abortion is safe and legal, that's great. But what about our sister, and not just sisters, our sisters and brothers? I mean, you know, these are often families making these decisions. The majority of women who get abortions already have families. They simply can't incorporate another child into their life or into their finances. So, you know, we need to make sure everyone has this right. And we need to change, primarily, I honestly think we need to change the electoral laws, because otherwise we're going to continue to be ruled by a minority that's trying to legislate us culturally into the early 20th century, right? Because after Roe v. Wade could very well come, you know, same-sex marriage could come, you know, marriage between the races. So, you know, these things cannot be relegated back to the states, because the majority of Americans want these practices to continue.
Right. Okay, unfortunately, that is all we have time for, but I thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having the show, Grace.
Thank you. Yeah, and I apologize for the technical difficulties, but you were wonderful, so thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. For our next story, spring is upon us, and people are starting to emerge from their winter cocoons and explore the city, where there are secrets in plain sight. Fans of New York should keep their eyes peeled for Guastavino tiles, special ceramic tiles that are both beautiful and incredibly strong. They can be found in more than 250 historical sites throughout the city, including Grand Central and Ellis Island. Named for the architect who patented them, the story of the Guastavino tiles is a story of immigrants, a story of art, and a story of New York's hidden beauty. Anna Miller and Lisa Schmidt have a story.
These are Guastavino tiles, Rafael Guastavino.
We're on a tour of the secrets of Grand Central Terminal. The Untapped City's tour guide, John DeSanto, is leading a group of 16 around the building and sharing historical facts. Towards the end, he narrows in on one man's work.
At the turn of the century, he was very, very popular. He did some of the most beautiful tile work, and these are his tiles.
Some in the group are tourists, and others are longtime New Yorkers, learning new things about sites they've passed by a million times all across the city.
The Great Hall at Ellis Island is Guastavino tiles. St. John the Divine, Guastavino tiles. The first subway stop, City Hall downtown, is absolute beautiful work, all Guastavino tiles. And when we go downstairs, you will see the gallery and the oyster bar. Again, beautiful Guastavino tiles.
Guastavino tiles are special ceramic tiles that allow architects to construct low arch ceilings, or vaults, that are both decorative and incredibly strong. The technique is actually 1,000 years old and originated in North Africa, eventually making its way up into the Mediterranean. The tiles can be found in hundreds of U.S. buildings today because a Spanish architect named Rafael Guastavino introduced the technique after emigrating to New York from Barcelona in 1881. Together with his son, he started a company producing these tiles that would influence American architecture for the next 50 years.
The Guastavinos were not architects themselves. They were essentially builders who were hired by the leading architects of the day. And I really like to think of the father and son as old world masters who brought these techniques.
This is John Oxendorf, a professor of architecture and civil engineering at MIT, who focuses on structural engineering of traditional buildings. He has dedicated the last 20 years to collecting and documenting examples of Guastavino works around the country. In 2010, he published his book, Guastavino Vaulting, The Art of Structural Tile, which describes the story of the Guastavino family and their legacy.
Once you know about the story of the Guastavino family, you see projects all around you. And so that is also part of the intrigue, is discovering personal connections to buildings. No, I would wager that most Americans have a connection to a space that was built by the Guastavino family. Most of us have walked through a space without realizing it.
Some of the tour group had this exact realization.
We sat in the oyster bar all
around
them.
And didn't even realize it until after we saw them. And then
and
I looked
in the
at
background
a, picture,
of a picture.
And they're in the background.
Guastavino tiles are glazed and come in different colors, white, green, terracotta orange, and gray, and are arranged in a herringbone pattern to create a vault. The vaults are typically made of 3 to 4 layers of the thin tiles that are about 1 inch thick and set with cement mortar. The tiles are rectangular and have a slight curve.
You can think of them almost like a brittle eggshell, and that is, they're very strong because of their curvature, but they're also quite thin. In fact, many of them are as thin as an eggshell by proportion. And so they get their strength from their curvature, just like an eggshell. And so their vaulting system could commonly hold hundreds of thousands of pounds. And it was kind of an astonishing construction method when it first arrives in New York in the 1880s, 1890s.
There are more than 250 works of Guastavino tiling in New York City alone. In the United States, only 600 of the nearly 1,000 examples of Guastavino vaults remain, as many have since been torn down. It's rare that people outside of the architectural world recognize these tiles that were used to build hundreds of historical U.S. buildings. But Ochsendorf says this is one of the great untold stories of American history.
It's a story of personal achievement, but it's also a story of great beauty and wonder. You know, I think this is a classical example of an immigrant family who brought their skills to make our country a better place, but whose work has been neglected, in part because their names are not on any of the buildings.
After the tour at Grand Central ends, a few of the participants,
Susan, Linda,
Marcia,
reflected on what they'd learned about Guastavino.
Yes. You know what? Look up. That's what I'm taking away.
Yeah, there's so much to see and appreciate.
So now that you know what to look for, keep your eyes peeled to see if you can spot some Guastavino tiles near you.
For our next story, Philip Rosenball's multimedia class covers the controversy over federal transportation mask mandates.
Public health decisions that affect a large number of people should be in the power of the government. Individual liberties cannot take precedent over the health and safety of the community.
I think it depends on each state. Some states are more strict with their mask mandate policy on like public services or public areas.
It's like lifted from the federal government, then I'll feel a little bit more safe because I know like I can kind of trust them. If it was just like a state or like some like random business, then probably not.
I feel like people who didn't want to abide by it weren't abiding by it anyway, and there wasn't a lot of ability to enforce it.
It's been over 2 years actually, and I just feel like everyone needs to start like moving on.
I take the subway and I don't see that many people wearing masks, so I usually don't wear mine. I mean, they were the ones who put it in the first place, so if they want to take it back, I guess it's their right to do it if they want. Like, I don't mind wearing the mask or anything, so.
The public transportation system is a government-run industry and system. The government has control over that, and it's the government's job to keep us the most safe that they can.
I always wear my mask on trains and stuff. I'd feel a lot safer if it stayed, but, you know, I get the want for this all to be over, but it's not. I'm kind of sick of people pretending that COVID's done, because it's not.
To tell you the truth, I really don't wear my mask on the same stuff. I vaccinated, double boosted, so it really doesn't make any sense of me wearing it.
You know, so used to wearing masks around that it's kind of scary to go in some place and nobody's wearing a mask.
Honestly, I don't really think anything of it. Honestly, I wasn't even wearing my mask most of the time, to be honest.
Keep it optional. Like, you can choose if you want to wear it, yes or no. Just like the one we have in my school.
I think it's a little too early, in my opinion. I mean, I'm not an expert, but that's what I think.
Nothing should be mandated. You can't force us to do nothing.
Until rates, like, drop and stay dropped. Like, stay low instead of the spikes.
We'd rather have people wearing masks right now, especially with the surge, like there's new surges.
In general level, I think federal government should have much more power on that kind of issues like airlines. The little I know about US politics.
I heard the CDC was thinking about letting some of these mask mandates expire anyway, and I don't think that they need to be in all locations anymore right now, but I, you know, there are cases where I would certainly like them to come back in.
Like, if I can do one little thing that helps other people not die, why wouldn't I do it, you know? So, you know, being aware of the science, you know, if I'm in fresh air places, really low risk, I'm not wearing a mask, if I'm in a congested area and others can be at risk to die, then I can put a mask on, it's okay.
We all want the best. Our next piece on the rundown today is about an unlikely target in cyber attacks, healthcare, Currently, the U.S. has the largest and most expensive healthcare system, yet is one of the most vulnerable to attacks. Just last month, both Congress and the Food and Drug Administration put out new proposals to protect weak points in the system. Rundown reporter Izzy McMahon talked to health security experts to get an overview of the problem and see where we are headed with the future of healthcare and cybersecurity.
We all want the best care for ourselves and loved ones in the hospital. We demand the best care, seek out the best doctors, and pay what we can when health problems arise. What happens when our doctors can't help us?
I woke up this morning with a headache, a fever, and I think a cold.
Personal health breaches have been on the rise since 2020. As technology changes and telemedicine booms, our privacy remains at risk, as well as our access to quality care.
If you think about a credit card, if there's a hack that exposes credit card data, you can change your credit card number.
That's Nicole Wetzman, a health tech reporter at The Verge.
Healthcare data includes a lot of very personal information, like social security numbers, insurance numbers, the amount of money that you're filing to insurance, a lot of very personal information that is very valuable on the black market because you can then turn around and sell it and use that information to file false medical claims.
Just last year, 40 million people in the U.S. had their personal health information hacked.
There is interesting research that shows that in the aftermath of a data breach like that, even though a data breach is not directly on a specific patient, you have increases in mortality rates at a facility.
To better understand the reason behind a failing system, I asked a cybersecurity expert.
You have 8,000 different hospital chains that are buying from 8,000 different medical device vendors. And that's just a recipe for kind of disaster.
That's Justin Capos, a professor at NYU Tandon School of Engineering.
We're very much working at the forefront of these kind of problems. We were the first to really focus in this area because it's an area that never really became academically very sexy.
A big push from folks who are on the cybersecurity side of things has been, okay, we need to do a better job of explaining to doctors, administrators, nurses, managers, things like that. Like, this is actually something you need to think about as part of your job as well.
Beyond just inside hospital rooms, the problem of implementing cybersecurity goes all the way up to the federal government.
When leadership changed back around 2016, everything became kind of a mess. Really, we got the runaround. Every agency told us this is really an important thing to do. You know, we're not the agency that funds this kind of work.
I think another area to pay attention to will be regulation and the Food and Drug Administration. They, you know, are responsible for regulating and overseeing medical devices. And medical devices now increasingly are connected to the internet. FDA has been really interested in cybersecurity, and they're hopefully looking to add kind of more attention to that as part of the review process.
As the FDA creates new legislation for medical software, new pathways forward are being forged in more than just the cybersecurity world. And as technology changes, it's up to more than just our doctors to change with them.
Healthcare data is very personal, and I think that it can be difficult, you know, when we live so much of our lives online, we're like, oh yeah, obviously nothing is private. But, you know, with healthcare information and things like that, people think about that differently than they do other types of information about themselves. And I think that recognizing that the spaces where you are vulnerable and your data is vulnerable and the systems that you're a part of are vulnerable are important to continue to draw attention to and to think about. Well,
in that case, this has been Izzy
Dr.
McMahon.
Adams isn't taking new patients.
I guess that's going to do it here for us tonight. If you liked what you heard or you want to hear something different, you can email us at news@wnyu.org. I'm Grace Monabo, and this has been The Rundown here on WNYU 89.1 FM, New York.